Previously.tv Podcast Network.
He has been doing so much better. He could have weeks left, months. He doesn't want to suffer anymore.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Beverly Hills 90210. Today's episode is Season 9, Episode 9, The Following Options. And now here are your hosts, Tari Ariano and Sarah D. Bunting. I have a question related to the title of this episode, The Following Options.
Yes.
You know when you call an office and they always tell you, please pay close attention to the following options because our menu item has recently changed.
Yeah.
Has their menu item recently changed, or is that just a standard thing they put now so that you actually pay attention to the following options?
Wow. That's a great question, because I wonder that too. Every time I feel like they say that.
You know, and you'll call a place 1 month and you'll call the place 6 months later and it still says that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're in the, phone software industry and you know what the deal is, drop us a line, David@cole.fyi or on Twitter or whatever. These are questions I would love to have. Seriously,
yeah.
I'm not joking. I would love to have that answered.
Especially when it's something like a bank. Like, how many options could there possibly be that they would be changing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. We've recently moved, I would like to rob this bank, from 3 to 7.
All right. Well, that's all I wanted to say. All right. Thanks.
You have selected Regicide.
Hi. You know what to do.
And we're done. Just making up for last week's giant episode.
No, this is going to be a real episode, starting with our D plot. Donna befriends a gang member, 3 question marks. Because what the fuck?
It's so, not an acting gang. Spoiler.
Oh, no, it's not. So Gina has just finished side-eyeing Donna while she convinces a customer to add a sweater to a pile of shit she's buying, when a younger girl, whose name we will eventually learn is Sonia, comes in wearing baggy sweatpants and starts looking at dresses. Donna is, of course, friendly and tells her to try on anything she wants. But then 2 of Sonia's rougher looking cohorts come in and start roasting the pink dress she picked out. Team cohort. Soon, a 4th girl comes in and throws, I guess, a gang sign. You can see this in the visual aids because I gift it, because it's ridiculous.
It totally looks like when, I don't know if you did this, but like you made that perfection symbol and then you like put it somewhere on you and someone had to give you a shot.
Oh,
or
you'd
get punched. Yeah.
Yeah.
It looked like that. I was like, ooh, scary.
What's
Are we making cootie
symbol?
Catchers?
What was that, Dave?
What's the perfection symbol?
Like, okay.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Why didn't you say okay?
Now the white power sign secretly,
yes.
Apparently.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
It started, well, I mean, this is like, you would have to look up an explainer for it, but apparently it's a 4chan thing that started where
people
were like, let's do that and pretend it means white power, but then they did it, so it just means white power now.
Great. Sort of like Canadians from a couple
yes.
years ago calling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Yep. Anyway, both the customer and Gina are suspicious, the latter trying to hustle them out by claiming they're about to close for lunch. Donna overrules her that they'll work through lunch, but the original customer, Sonia, takes off without any of her stuff and then knocks some sunglasses off a shelf and kicks them out the door, which is weird. And then when they're gone, Donna says they're just kids, but Gina does their W sign and says it means they're gangbangers. Donna didn't notice. But then again, Donna's also a dumb baby. And then Sonia comes back in to return the sunglasses. I don't know. It makes no sense why any of that happened. Whatever. The next day, Sonia comes back alone and looks at the same dress, which Donna says would look great on her. Sonia says her dad got a job so they can invite everyone to her 15th birthday. And I'm not sure if they didn't feel like explaining what a quinceañera is.
Thank
or that
you.
They okay, or they decided, okay, we can't have her be a gang member and like the 4th Latinx character on the show in history. So then they were like, well, she's just sort of dark, but not necessarily of any particular ethnic background.
Okay.
Perfection. My notes said, thanks. Shouldn't an Angelino know that it's a quinceañera? But I guess not. I think your explanation is legit as for why that is.
Yeah. So Donna takes it to a fitting room for her while Gina watches suspiciously and then tells Donna to check her bag before she leaves. Donna defends Sonia against every shitty thing Gina says. And Sonia's happy when she comes out until she looks at the price tag and sees that this piece of garbage is $120 and asks if they do layaway. Donna's ready to do it, but this girl needs the dress for tonight and can totally pay her for it with her wages from her after school job. And Gina is suspicious some more, but Donna will totally let her leave paying $0 for this dress if she just gives her contact info and her employer's name, though she looks a little nervous about it. And Gina says this, clip two.
Look, you pity her. For that, you'll pay.
What the fuck, as I have in my notes, what the fuck is this Samuel Richardson ass writing? Like, what the
fuck? Confucius say, pity cost.
Yeah. All right. I mean, Vanessa Marsil does her best to sell it, but Jesus Christ. Dave, yeah. did you have something?
I didn't say anything.
Oh, I thought you were breaking in to say more about the okay sign. So Sonia comes back later that night.
I'm against it.
Thank you. This time with her posse and claims the dress was messed up and she's not going to pay for it. Don is all quavery voiced asking what the problem was. And Sonia says it was ripped when she bought it, but then pulls out a switchblade and slashes it in front of her. The girls all laugh and leave without causing any further damage. Believable. Donna quietly tells Sonia she trusted her and Sonia loudly says she screwed up. And then Donna feels like a chump in front of Gina. And Sonia shows up at the store the next day with $10 and a promise to pay Donna the rest. She says she didn't want to do all of that and is willing to work off what she owes. Donna asks about the birthday party and Sonia admits it was a huge deal, but that Lucy told her if she went, she was out of the gang. For some reason, she doesn't claim she isn't in a gang and further just volunteers the information that she's needed for an upcoming drug run. Because in her neighborhood, you're either in the gang or you're a target. There are no more after-school programs where she lives. At this moment, Donna confidently asserts that one day her gang sisters will get her arrested or killed because, you know, who knows about a lot about gangs? Donna.
Hey, she worked a whole shift at a convenience store in the ghetto one time.
Oh, that's true. She did. I take it back. On to our C-plot, Samantha's gay and Steve can't handle it. So Steve and David are on their way out after hanging out in Sam's dressing room at the studio when David asks if he can interview her on his stupid radio show. He has to explain that it's not rock, it's alternative, and shit gets awkward in clip three.
David, I'm honored, but I don't consider myself alternative.
No, that's not what he meant.
I don't want to be a spokesperson for the gay lifestyle.
Did you just say...
Would you excuse us for a minute?
Yeah, okay, sure.
I thought that's why he wanted me on the show.
He's a fan. In ninth grade, he used to trail after me, wanting to meet you.
Haven't you talked to anyone about this?
No. I wanted to protect your privacy.
I know this is hard for you. I told you it's okay to talk to your friends.
You're gay. Congratulations, Mom. What else is there to say?
The truth? That you're ashamed of me?
Steve, you shitheel.
Yeah. Also, the easy on the more you know piano.
I know. Almost every scene ends with like really aggressive music, and some of them I left in, some of them I didn't, but like it's really out of control.
Yeah.
Feller. So it turns out Samantha is going to do David's stupid show. Steve advises him to steer clear of the personal angle and suggests that being gay is just another phase for Samantha. David thinks she knows what she wants, but then loses any points we might have given him immediately in clip four.
My mom's girlfriend's name is Linda, Steve. You mean to tell me that the thought of two women together doesn't excite you?
Oh, yeah. It's a fantasy of mine.
You see?
Not when one's my mother, though.
Okay. What the fuck was David's point? I mean, yes, we know that this is a thing that a person like Steve would be into, but, like, it's his mom. And also, is David's point, like, it's okay for women to be gay because it's titillating to men? What the fuck were you getting at, you fucking idiot?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure that was exactly his point. And more to the point, he knows that that point will appeal to Steve.
Right.
But you're talking about his mom.
It's gross.
You have spoiled Eat.
Also, if David thinks that Samantha started dating a woman to gratify men, I hope he will do more research before this interview actually happens. But anyway, Janet then has to call Steve to the phone because a real tabloid is calling to talk to him about Samantha. And Steve handles it perfectly. JK, of course, he doesn't. Clip 5.
What's it like being raised by a... Get a life, you vulture. And get your facts straight. I'm adopted.
Oh, Steve. You fucking garbage.
Oh, my God. I mean, maybe Rush is the lesbian. He is his bio dad, right?
Right. So the National Whisperer, has put out a cover story on Hartley's House of Secrets in that mom was gay and her wild lifestyle puts dark shadow over family sitcom. We see that it's Samantha looking at it in her dressing room as Steve lets himself in. He calls it garbage and says nobody reads it, which I guess is why he's trying to turn his own publication into a 40th generation photocopy of it. But Samantha reports that the guy who plays her husband on this show dropped a kiss at the end of a scene out of fear that she would hate it, which I doubt it. I doubt an actor would have that problem. He's probably gay. Anyway, Steve just keeps repeating that it's a worthless rag no one takes seriously, but Samantha says she does and wants to know if Steve told a reporter that he wasn't her son. And she has to ask twice before he finally admits it and then gets upset, saying they have no right to pry. Things get a little bit muddled from there. Clip 6.
It's their job. That's what they do. You chose this life. The celebrity, all of it.
I did not choose to be gay. What sort of mother would suit you? Should I bake cookies, volunteer at the library, run a Girl Scout troop?
They wouldn't let you. I didn't mean that.
Have I always had these feelings? I don't know. Maybe. If I was afraid to act on them, can you blame me?
You want my honest response? Okay. Don't do this. Just... don't.
Is she going to like war or something?
Yeah, what the hell?
Is she about to be deployed to the...
She's about to be airlifted from...
See you in Iwo Jima, lady. Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really dumb. And it's like, he comes around, but this is a really stupid part of this whole storyline.
Yeah, and you almost care about it because the actor playing Samantha Sanders is really good,
as usual. She's good.
She's way above the material that she gets stuck with, and I've always been a little surprised, frankly, that she would agree to come back after all these years, but I'm glad she did.
Yep. So Steve leaves, and then a PA comes in to say that Samantha's agent called about an emergency meeting with producers and or executives. And this PA is really inappropriately cheerful about this meeting, which is obviously going to be really bad. But you can see her not correct facial expressions in the visual aids. So Samantha finds Steve faking sick at home to hide out because he's embarrassed about the publicity surrounding his gay mom. And it probably won't be that big an issue anymore, though, because she's been fired. Steve is a jerk, but he's also loyal, and so he's appalled on her behalf, even though officially it was a creative decision to write her character out. And she turns it back around on him and his hypocrisy, since even he doesn't want a homosexual in his living room. And then Steve's all suspicious that she's always known she was gay and just adopted him for her cover story, but she intensely says that holding him convinced her that being his mother was the only good decision she ever made. Aww. Then he grew up into Steve, so that's gotta sting.
Yeah, well, Rush.
Yeah. So Steve makes poor Samantha meet him at the Peach Pit After Dark so he can tell her he still thinks that she should let David interview her whether or not she's still on the show because she has a lot of fans and people love her and she should be proud like he is. And they're going to make Samantha sit in this stupid booth and get interviewed live by David in the middle of this loud club and surprise, he fucking sucks. Clip 7.
Okay, this is very exciting. Tonight, we have the extremely talented, the lovely, the mom you wish you had, the Hartley House's own Samantha Sanders.
Get to it. Jesus Christ.
Also, do some prep, you jackass. Oh, yeah. My God.
I'm sure this interview was extremely insightful. Are you aware of all the guys that are going to be beating off to the thought of your Hartley House character making out with a lady? Asks David, we presume.
Ew.
Fucking David. We do have more episode, but first, we have a message from a different Sarah.
This Sarah writes, I've been listening to the Again With This podcast since the beginning, and occasionally my husband and I listen to it on road trips. We were doing just that when Hannah was 3 and we thought asleep. All of a sudden, we hear a little voice from the backseat exclaim, fucking Donna, at a girl kid. This is her daughter, by the way, in case that wasn't clear.
Sarah tells us that Hannah is turning 6 today, so we've come up with 5 reasons Hannah's birthday is far better than anyone in the gang.
Number 1, it's always the same day every year and doesn't move around according to plot device needs, unlike Kelly's.
And unlike Kelly, Hannah will probably not celebrate it by swooning onto the floor of a diner bathroom after taking too many diet pills. Hannah, do not do this. Cake is literally your birthright. Enjoy it.
Number 3, Hannah is considerate enough to be born September 24th, not December 25th, like a certain dumb baby present hog we might mention. Fucking Donna, indeed.
Number 4, and she doesn't have to share it with a twin like Brenda and Brandon Walsh did, although come to think of it, we never saw their birthday, did we? Were the Walshes Jehovah's Witnesses?
Number 5, we'll get back to number 4. Number 5, and if she does rent an entire cruise ship for her party one day, we hope she stays on board to get her money's worth instead of winding up in a bar brawl with Pauly Shore.
Honestly, that's just math. From your sweary podcast aunties and your mom, happy birthday, Hannah! It's true, we didn't ever see the twins' birthday. It's weird.
It's weird. And there were summer episodes. Yeah.
Anyway, on to our B-plot. Gina gets hot pants for Dylan. So for those who aren't watching along, like our very own David T. Cole, I want to play a bit of this music and ask what you think, Dave, is happening on screen while this is playing. Clip 8.
I have 2 possible answers.
Okay.
One is the sun is rising on the Malibu area beach.
Sure.
People are eating breakfast at some sort of restaurant mm-hmm. on the beach. And
right.
The second answer is Nightman's around.
Yeah, you're close.
Well, both of those guesses are wrong. He's washing his fucking car. That's the soundtrack. Of Dylan watching his car.
Oh, that guy fucks his car.
Yeah. So then Dylan parks at the Peach Pit after dark where his fucking car is immediately swarmed by a bunch of Chads who are like, she's beautiful. And Dylan's all mournful like she was. And Gina inside is trying to get Noah to go to a movie with her while he's tending bar. And he distractedly tells her to talk to Donna and they can all go this week. But she says Donna has to work. And then Dylan inserts himself in clip 9.
He rejected you.
Hey, that was a question, not an offer.
Yeah, right.
He's a friend. Thanks.
Let's keep it that way.
Okay, that sound that you could kind of hear was the beer that Noah threw to Dylan exploding everywhere where he opens it because he's still drinking. And according to people commenting on the forums, he just continues to drink until the end of the series. And it's never mentioned that he's a recovering alcoholic.
Yeah. All right.
So then Dylan decides to offer some unsolicited advice about one of the parking lot guys currently getting into Gina's personal space. Clip 10.
This guy's a little wasted and he's got a pretty short fuse. I'd watch him.
Yeah, I saw him. Not serving him.
You're not serving him? Well, that's a start.
I'll take your course on what I should do next. In the meantime, relax, right?
It's just funny to me when these two, like, face off because, like I said in the last episode, you know, Noah is the warped mirror version of Dylan, but also they're both such pissy assholes. It's like, I can't root for either of you. Both of you just go jump into volcano, please.
Yeah. I just really loved, like, I tried to get a freeze frame of it for the visual aids, but I don't think I succeeded. But Vincent Young did pull this, for him, quite eloquently pissy face during this exchange. And I was going to caption it, thank you for coming to my TED Talk. I couldn't quite get the look. And don't watch the episode to find it. It's not that good.
When we're offline, I'll tell you how to, in VLC, how to slow down the frame rate so that you can capture it, because
hot
that sounds important.
Tara's tech tips.
Yep. Subscribe.
I'm not doing it.
Like and subscribe for more. Unfortunately, Dylan turns out to be right about this guy who starts pawing at Gina's number one shoulder blade tattoo, calls her a trailer park skank. She throws a drink in his face. He tries to grab her and Dylan has to pull him off, and Gina immediately has a new object of her for her affections. You can like see the scales falling from her eyes as she realizes that Noah is the shitty version of Dylan. But Dylan ignores her to whine at Noah for stopping him before he punched that dude, I guess. And then David appears to lead Dylan off, Dylan telling David to keep Noah out of his face. Hey, here's a thought. Go drink somewhere else. Or actually don't. You're supposed to be in recovery.
Yeah. But you live in a hotel. Go to the bar.
I think he lives with David now, but either way.
Oh, yeah.
Then Chad and his other Chad buddies take out their aggression all over Dylan's precious car, slashing a tire, smashing up the windows and headlights, and Dylan comes out mid-attack, and the show tries to make us think this broken-down old man can take care of three aggressive college students by himself. And Gina comes running out just in time to stop Dylan from using the switchblade he took off Chad to slash his throat, I guess. But Dylan lets the guy go, and Gina is, of course,
what
only hornier.
What is everyone having switchblades last couple of episodes?
I know.
What is it, the 60s?
I know. So Gina's, of course, only hornier after this display, and Dylan is only weirder in clip 11.
Is this your car?
Get away from her.
And then Nightman, standing 10 feet away, is playing a plaintive saxophone solo that has nothing to do with the PTSD we're supposed to assume
that
Dylan is suffering.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is this your car?
Get away from her.
The beard stays, you go!
If you are not listeners to Extra Hot Great, our sister podcast, please go to previously.tv, click shows, scroll down to Nightman, and revisit all of the times we've discussed Nightman, because it's a lot and no one remembers that show.
It's more than the people who created Nightman discuss Nightman. Trust me.
So true. So after the commercial, Dylan's in the garage that David suddenly has, fixing up his poor baby car. David walks in, of course, in this sextuple XL sweater, which is baby blue, and his posture is so bad he looks like a pregnant woman. Like, he's so sway backed, he looks like he's walking womb first. If I were being charitable, I'd say he looks like Shaggy from Scooby-Doo, but I'm not. Anyway, despite the fact that Dylan and Noah seemed like they wanted to fight the night before, Noah has popped by to opine about the car and offer to help, and no surprise, Dylan declines. And after David's gone inside, Noah pokes at one of the seats and tells Dylan he has a hole. And this sends Dylan into a flashback to the night Tony was killed. And Noah tries again to set him up with some guy who handles vintage cars. And Dylan says no again. And Noah's all pissy about his refusal to take the help Noah's offering. As if that has not been Noah's whole storyline since he came on the show. Like, fuck off.
Oh, my God.
So Dylan's under his car when Gina saunters up with a pizza, ice cream, and a six-pack of brew. Like... Hey. It's obviously Heineken, but like no one possibly even felt like making up a German name for this fake beer. So it just says brew.
Hot summer day. You have thirst. Brew. It has taste.
But earlier in this episode, they had changed a Diet Coke can to just say cola. But then in the next scene, they changed camera angles and you can clearly see the words Diet Coke. But no one cared, including Coca-Cola. They're like, just
whatever.
If we don't look directly at it, maybe it doesn't exist.
So she lays all this stuff out on the floor of the garage, gross, to say it's for his hunger and thirst and for coming to her rescue. And she knows how to handle guys like that, she claims. And I guess we'll see, because Dylan starts negging her as hard as Chad did in clip 12.
Who was your first serious boyfriend anyway? Some hillbilly? You know, beer, pizza, low-cut top. You really think guys are that simple?
I've had boyfriends.
Yeah, boys.
Look, I might have been a little busy. Skating was my life. I was a national finalist.
Were you number one? It's a legitimate question.
Well, I finished a 3-minute program with a broken ankle.
Well, competition must have been fierce.
Duh.
You know their gain is your loss. Everybody's always trying to take what you got.
Well, right, that's the way of the world, right?
That's one way to look at it. Here's another. You have this cousin, she takes you in. You thank her.
Yeah, I'm very grateful to her.
You don't try to take what she has, because Donna's happiness does not cost you a point.
Would you do watch some documentary on figure skaters?
Why Noah? I mean, really, of all the guys in this town, why Noah?
Seriously.
If you get him, you know that all you've done is get the wrong guy. Definitely not first place, and definitely not number one. You can get tattoos removed, you know, if it's not working for you.
Shut the fuck up.
Also, what is with acting like tattoos are like these super trashy, like seriously, everyone had tattoos by this time.
Yeah, it's not like season one with the Palm Springs episode where like the rough girls show up and Steve is put off when he sees that one of them has a tattoo. Like,
yeah,
it was not uncommon at this point.
No.
I mean, is her tattoo tacky? Yes. Should she have it removed? Probably at least covered up because it's ugly. But
well, yeah. Just a little rubbing alcohol will take that right off because clearly fake.
Well, yes.
Came
but
from
also
a machine.
Like, this would have been an opportunity for him to say, like, I knew another girl who had a tattoo in that exact place, because that's where Val's tattoo is also. And he was weird about that one, too.
Yeah.
Ew. But no one remembers or cares.
Guess he wants to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. It's okay.
Hey, that's my joke.
So Gina shows up at the store while Donna and Noah are rudely eating dinner at the register and demands to know what Dylan's deal is. Noah has had three conversations with Dylan, so he thinks he knows. Clip 13.
Don't touch his car. He's very particular about his car.
His wife was shot in that car.
I mean,
I know that's for the benefit of people who just started watching the show, if they exist, but it's still hilarious. Like, and the reaction that Vincent Young gives, like he's just frozen in place with his chopsticks in front of his mouth, like, whoops, it's really funny.
It's, yeah, it's amazing. The writers will catch like old viewer or new viewers up on that, but they don't seem to remember that Noah's fiance died in his car.
Right.
Is that even when he has like a perfect opportunity to bring that up, he doesn't.
Right. Or that he's like shocked to hear that someone's gotten shot, even though like five people that he knows personally have gotten shot on the show since he came on the show a year ago.
Yeah. It's weird.
Anyway, after Noah has left, Gina tries to get dirt on why Kelly and Donna didn't work out. And Donna basically tells her not to try it. And then Dylan's waking up screaming from nightmares about Tony when Noah comes in to make sure that Dylan's okay. And of course, Dylan doesn't want his help ever again, some more. But Noah follows him into the kitchen to say he didn't know about the car's tragic history in clip 14.
As far as those dreams and night sweats you're having, I've had them. I know what they're about. My old man killed himself and I knew this girl. It wasn't my favorite topic either, right?
So are we blood brothers now?
Yeah, sure. Whenever you're ready, man.
I wouldn't sit by the phone.
And Nightman. I mean, I guess he sort of implies it.
Right.
There, but that really strikes me as like, well, we think there was something, but there's like one person who was here.
Right.
When he first came on the show, and we don't remember.
Right. Yes, and it's not like they can go on Hulu and rewatch the episodes or like look for recaps because that was, well, I guess recaps existed, but anyway.
Yeah.
Also,
true.
The night, so they mention the night sweats and they have to show that like Dylan's in a, you know, medium gray t-shirt, but it could not look more like he just stood there while someone sprayed him with a spray bottle. Like, this is not the pattern of what night sweats look like when you've sweated through your shirt at all.
No.
And
they unfortunately spritzed what's left of his hair. So it's.
Oh, yeah.
It's not good. His hair. He now has a shelf head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like from the side, it's like perfectly planed on top.
Mm-hmm. So as Noah's walking out, Dylan is dismembering a pizza box and takes the lid of it outside to put on the windshield for this 56 Speedster is now for sale. And when we see it again, some old asshole is buying Dylan's car and drives it out of the Peach Pit After Dark parking lot just in time for Gina to come outside sniffing around. They talk about the car's true meaning tiresomely. She volunteers that she got laser surgery on her tattoo today because of him. Barf.
Which she could afford because...
Right.
She in a gang now?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Seriously. So she offers to drive him somewhere, but he's not going home yet. And where he goes is to Skid Row to light the old guy's cash on fire over an oil drum. Some douche. Other dude wanders over to ask what he's doing. And he says he's burning his wife's ashes. Jesus Christ. Why wouldn't you just set the car itself on fire? Because he loves it.
Also, the person on the 50s, the fake 50s, is like Colonel Sanders. Like,
oh,
it's
really?
It's not. Yeah. I always look at this stuff. I don't know why. It's obviously fake money. And then it's like, it's just some guy who with like a string tie. Like, what?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So this friendly stranger watching a guy literally burn cash happens to be a merchant. Clip 15.
Listen, maybe I got a little something to help you out.
Highly unlikely.
Nobody comes around here unless you are looking for a little something. I got some smoke, rock, I got some meth, some smack.
Orange juice.
Smack. You looking for a little heroin? Okay. You wait right here.
I've got to go get my list of even more synonyms for drugs.
Yeah. So Dylan has just found 100 and has barely lit it on fire before the dealer comes back, snaps it out of his hands, and gives him his heroin. Da, da, da. On to our A-plot. Kelly has cigarette problems. So because everyone who wants to fuck Kelly has to lurk outside the store and stalk her, it's Matt's turn. Also, he's finally smoking. But then he comes in to see if she wants to drive around.
No, that's not what he's doing.
Well, okay. He has a lit cigarette moving between his mouth and his fingers.
Mm.
No?
I mean, no, he is trying to smoke.
It's weird
camera.
To me that when actors can't sell it, because like I just always assume all actors smoke.
Yeah.
Anyway, he comes in to see if she wants to drive around Hancock Park and look at Christmas lights, which I guess is all he can afford. But then Jackie calls in a panic because Grandpa can't breathe. I don't know. Ask a doctor or nurse at the hospital where he is currently living, but he has pneumonia. They want to put him on a machine that will breathe for him, which I think most adults would call a ventilator. Kelly reminds Jackie that he doesn't want to be on any machines, but Jackie anxiously says he's struggling for every breath, and if he's not intubated, he'll die. And Kelly reminds her again about the living will, which, as she recalls, Kelly is now in charge of. But Jackie tries to guilt her by saying that he's been doing better and could still have weeks or months to live. And Kelly says he doesn't want to suffer anymore, and Jackie yells that he needs air. And Kelly asks to speak to the doctor. How do we know that Jackie's actually handed the phone to the right person? Clip 16.
Hello, this is the doctor.
Hi, I'm Kelly Taylor. I'm his power of attorney.
We need a decision.
Do whatever it takes. Save him.
Oh, that oboe. It was so sad.
And then.
And then.
It had its world rocked.
Hello, I mean, this is a doctor. I'm going to start answering my phone like that, by the way.
Oh, yeah, same. And he might have just been walking past on his way to the OB ward. Hello, yeah. This is a doctor. And then she's like, do whatever it takes. Save him.
Yeah.
Like, he's asking whether they should destroy some files that might or might not be 7 years old. Like, mm-hmm.
Right.
Might as well keep them. Like,
right.
Anything, Jenny.
Kelly.
Anything.
You're so bad at this. So the next day, Kelly calls Donna with an update, which is that it's upsetting to see her grandpa on a ventilator. Like, imagine how he must feel, you fucking idiot. This is the opposite of what he wanted.
Yeah. He's also unable to yell at you assholes because ventilator.
Right. Kelly asks if the tube hurts, and the doctor... Hello, this is a doctor. Way too cheerfully says he's on painkillers. but that they will need him to write on a chalkboard or work out hand signals to communicate because he could be on the ventilator indefinitely. Cool, 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 Kelly. This is exactly what his living will stated he wanted to happen. Jackie says that Kelly saved his life, but Kelly regrets this is how he's going to spend whatever time he has left. Kelly's dumb. Kelly is asleep on a couch at the hospital when Matt wakes her up to get the latest from the doctor. He's wandering around when he runs into an ex-colleague who's there to take a deposition. Dave, by the way, this ex-colleague is the teacher of the Brooklyn Nine-Nine mask-making class, that episode we just recently rewatched. It's that guy. Matt admits that he's not doing great. His old buddy may have a solution in clip 17.
That's so sad. This woman's 47. She's been fighting lung cancer for 3 years, a tobacco company for two.
Both losing battles.
It's easy work. Questions by the numbers, a lot of billable hours.
And you pay me half what the tobacco company's paying you?
A third. Nice try.
Matt.
Give me a call.
Yeah.
Are you cutting a deal to work with a tobacco company?
Kelly, I could explain, but you wouldn't understand.
And why is that?
Because your grandfather has emphysema.
Also because she's shown a demonstrated unwillingness to acknowledge that you, an attorney, have to represent your client's interests zealously, even if it's not convenient for her tiny mouth ass.
Yeah, but I also don't know why the tobacco industry lawyer would be like, it's very sad. You know what I mean? Like, it's weird to say. I don't know what side he's on, because, like, I feel like that's something you don't say if you're representing the tobacco company.
Yeah, I feel like someone got confused as to who was supposed to be representing whom, and couldn't they have just written this so that Matt gets to represent the plaintiff? But
yeah,
whatever.
Right. So later, Kelly's walking by the elevator when a nurse treating this Mrs. Klein says she overheard Matt's conversation with the patient and that he's scum. Kelly is also disgusted, but passive-aggressively doesn't comment and pivots to say she doesn't get the point of smoking. And Matt says that nicotine is addictive and it's something to do with your hands. And he tries to change the subject by flattering her, saying she makes him nervous. She says she was happy to see him when she woke up the other day, but she wishes he was not there doing this. Matt says there are two sides, so she tells him to be on her side, and they have this exchange, clip 18.
Looking at you right now, I couldn't imagine being on any other, but your grandfather knew the dangers of smoking.
So it was his fault that he got emphysema?
Look, there's a warning right on the label, right there.
You smoke?
No, I started again recently.
So this isn't about freedom of choice. This is defending your own habit.
No, two separate issues. The fact is, Kelly, I represent all types of clients.
Let me just ask you something. If a client came to you and said, I'm thinking of killing someone
with a drug like nicotine,
you wouldn't help them do it, would you?
Okay. If he really is just taking this job for the money, which is how it's been represented to us, this is an incredibly insensitive thing for him to say to her right now. Like, it just is. And also, her grandfather definitely did not know the dangers of smoking if, as we've established, he started in like the 1930s. You know what I mean? Like, by the time the dangers were known, he was already addicted. This is the point of all of these lawsuits.
Yeah. Which had, P.S., been lost in a huge landslide by now. Wasn't that when, like, this happened in, like, 95?
I think this was pre the events of, like, The Insider, so yeah.
Yeah,
where what turned the tide was that the tobacco companies knew and were hiding data and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and not for nothing, but she was in rehab or cocaine addiction.
Right.
Maybe a little compassion for anyone.
Yeah. That's
what
a great
am I saying?
Point. Yes, but she didn't know the dangers of cocaine because it wasn't written on the label of her cocaine.
Danny Five, that's an oversight. that's why you're supposed to, you know, buy the cocaine that has the stamp on it. Don't just buy it out of the back of someone's car.
What? Yeah. So Kelly goes to see her grandfather. Jackie has to tell her he pulled the ventilator out himself, but He's breathing on his own. And the doctor comes out to say he no longer has pneumonia, but that his prognosis isn't going to change. When Kelly goes in to see her grandfather, she gets upset to see that he's in restraints because he was trying to get out of bed. And we all know Kelly's a shithead, but it's time Grandpa told her so to her face. Clip 19.
I can't stand this.
I didn't know what to do, Grandpa.
I told you, let me die.
It was for his own good.
Did you see what they did to him?
Kelly.
They strapped him down, Mom.
Yes, I know.
What I did, I convinced myself that I did it for him, but I didn't. I did it for me. And I had to make the decision about whether to keep him alive or not. I actually thought about Christmas morning and how much I would miss him if he wasn't there.
I want him with us, too. You thought you were being selfish. You weren't. You love him.
And I should let him go.
One day.
The rare mid-episode credit sting. Yeah, you should have let him go, you fucking asshole. Jesus Christ. Why did you agree to do this? Why are you so dumb? Why are you like this?
This is a doctor.
So Dylan rolls up just then and Kelly whines at him to take her away. And they end up at a fucking playground on the fucking swings again, where neither of them brings up the time he had to come find her there when she was crying about being voted most beautiful in high school. And she's remorseful that she didn't let the doctors give Grandpa morphine so he could just slip away into death. And she's annoyed that he's just saying platitudes at her. But he says Grandpa's dying no matter what. The only question is whether it'll be Grandpa's way or hers. And Kelly has a lot to think about. There is more to the storyline, alas. But first, we have a message for Estelle.
Allison tells us that she and Estelle met in a marathon training group 18 years ago and, barring interruptions for things like work travel or pregnancy, have been running together weekly ever since. That sounds like the exact opposite of my friendship with Tara, but good for you both.
Yeah, let's never go running. Estelle and Allison have had lots of hours to fill on their runs, and over the past few years, a favorite topic is the podcasts they're listening to, including ours. Aw.
Aw. So with that in mind, for Estelle's birthday, Allison would like us to tell her which podcast each member of the gang should host or appear on. This is actually a topic we covered in a mini episode last year, so in order not to duplicate ourselves, we're going to focus on the gangsters who weren't on the show then. To wit.
Number one, as a lawyer, Matt should obviously go on Mike Dicta, America's best named legal podcast. Host Charles Starr has a large rotating cast of attorneys practicing in a variety of specialties. And since Matt works in all the specialties, he'd be an excellent asset. JK, they would roast him hard.
Number two, Gina would make a good guest on Forever 35, partly because as a retired Olympian, she's probably developed some solid self-care strategies, but also so that co-hosts Kate and Dory could turn it into a stealth intervention as they point out how her schemes are not serving her life's larger purpose.
No. And number three, given his clearly conflicted season 9 attitude, I'd put Dylan on. I hate it, but I love it. In part because it would be funny if he made Kat and Jocelyn talk about some kind of Marx Brothers bullshit.
Oh my God. Having just listened to their Julie and Julia podcast the other day, I really feel like he would be drowned in a boot by like minute 17.
So true.
If I'm wrong, don't tell me. We are happy to make introductions between these fictional characters and our real online friends.
Seriously, though, these are all real podcasts and they're spectacular, and we'll link them in the show notes for you, Estelle and Allison, and for all of our listeners.
On behalf of all of us and Allison,
happy birthday, Estelle! All right, back to our A-plot. Later, Kelly is reminiscing to Matt about Grandpa being strong enough to throw her over his head when she was in fifth grade. And that was when she was fat. So that really meant something. He could have lived so much longer if not for... And then she rudely reaches inside Matt's breast pocket, like inside his jacket, to pull out his cigarettes. Jackie rolls up with the doctor. Hello, I'm a doctor. And reports that Grandpa hasn't eaten all day. Kelly says he hates hospital food, like he is trying to die. Figure it out. The doctor wants to talk to him about a feeding tube because he's not getting it either. And Jackie is horrified and calls that too much, whereas a ventilator was fine. And Matt says that if Grandpa's still competent, it's his choice whether or not to have a feeding tube. And Kelly sadly tells Jackie he's had enough. And Jackie agrees, asking how soon he can be released. The doctor would advise against it, but Jackie doesn't give a fuck now that it's too late. So Kelly goes to David's place to tell Dylan her grandpa's being released from the hospital the next day and is going to die. He tried to quit smoking, but he never could. And this makes her horny in clip 20.
I keep telling myself we're just old friends.
Does that work for you?
Not always. Something to do with your hands. That's what someone once told me about smoking.
Yesterday.
It's an addiction. It's terrible for you.
Keep saying I don't understand.
But you do. You know you do.
So do you, dumbass.
Yes. I was doing okay before you came back.
Yeah. Lately, I've been thinking this probably isn't very good for you.
I don't care.
And they kiss. Also, just in addition to the cocaine, like, she also has had treatment for her disordered eating. Like, she knows a lot about addiction, actually.
Yeah.
And so does he, as you point out.
She knows a lot about him.
Yeah.
And like, lately, you got back like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, maybe. It could be 2 weeks ago and it could be 3 days ago. Like, the timeline is very fluid. But anyway. Yeah. The next day, Jackie and Kelly stand smiling in the doorway as, over a chessboard, Matt and Grandpa swap stories about quitting smoking, which Matt just did 18 hours ago. And the Taylors apparently didn't tell Grandpa he was being released when they knew it, but anyway, they tell him and everyone's happy. And in the hall, Kelly pets Matt for quitting smoking. He also quit the cigarette case, so big day for Kelly's victories. He wants to make plans with her, but she stiffly puts him off, claiming Grandpa-related obligations. And he eventually gets the picture and gets into the elevator, warning her about the really great guy she could be missing out on, as if she didn't meet him 2 weeks ago. Maybe it was longer than that. A few months ago. Jackie and Kelly wheel Grandpa inside at Jackie's and surprise him with a decorated Christmas tree, even though the actual holiday is weeks away, apparently. Because they want him to stay there until he dies. Every day is a gift. Jackie knows what she's taking on, and they'll do whatever he wants. And Kelly promises that when the time comes, they'll let him die on his terms, though, of course, no one actually says die. And now presents. Hooray. Merry Christmas, everybody. That's the episode.
Wait, is Grandpa still alive?
Yeah.
Oh. For now.
For now. On to the episode MVP.
I mean, I think it's Grandpa for sticking around so long, right?
I was also going to say Grandpa for being very open about how badly he prefers the cold embrace of the grave to his fucking family, Kelly.
That's a good choice, but I'm going to say Sonya, the slasher of Donna dresses.
Also legit.
Least valuable player. The homophobic producers of Samantha's show.
The shithead who didn't check the Carfax before buying the Dylan mobile. Also, Dylan.
Yeah, good choices both. We have a user submitted challenge.
Whoops.
I scored some amazing stones.
We're just going to leave that in.
Okay. At VRussell8990 on Twitter asks us to list 5 ways in which Donna would benefit herself if she had normal boobs. Well, if she would be less hard to look at for us, that would probably mean we would roast her less, maybe.
If she's using herself as a fit model for her designs, that's probably not great for the average shopper.
I got one.
Yep.
When she's out somewhere and she's eating and something falls from her face and falls down. Like, that food's lost forever right now. Whereas if she had normal cleavage, it would have been trapped and she could enjoy that food later on.
Yeah, agree. Mm-hmm.
I mean, she wouldn't cast such weird shadows when she's photographed.
And she could sleep on her stomach a lot more comfortably.
Yeah, true. Well, that makes
well
five.
Good thing for everybody that we have perfect bodies.
Yeah. Look, whatever problems we have, the,
hey, it's not our fault. Let's just all concentrate on this terrible suggestion from this user. What was this user's name? This listener's name? Let's all blame that person.
VWrestle899.
Oh, I hate them so much.
Donna's boobs are weird. We talk about it a lot. It's not this user's slash listener's
yeah,
fault.
It really isn't.
It's Donna's slash Tori Spelling's plastic surgeon.
Hello, it's a doctor's fault.
Hi, this is a doctor. I went to medical school in Guadalajara. Let me please operate on your boobs.
My my doctor apparently was absent that day. Sorry.
Extra B is for bargain.
All right. We also have the Kim Challenge.
Bad, bad, and dangerous to me.
Five ways from this episode that Dylan proves he is mad, bad, and dangerous to know. I mean, well, he's using heroin. That's dangerous and bad.
He's lighting money on fire. I mean, granted, it's illegal currency that has Colonel Sanders on it, but still.
I thought you said a mummy. Like, I was like, I missed something about this episode. Let's go back and watch.
Yeah, for real.
I think there's some kind of madness in referring to his wife's death car as her.
He's bad at not being condescending to Gina.
And he's still drinking. Like, that's dangerous for an addict. Not that anyone's ever going to call him on it, apparently. Next five.
Speaking of Dylan, it's time to return once again to the hallowed pages of Luke Perry teen heartthrob. As we enter the chapter Heading to California, this font is huge. In 1985, Luke graduated from high school. Now he could finally pursue his dream of acting. He and a friend packed up a small car and drove 2,000 miles to Los Angeles, California.
Oh, sick. No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Quote, I moved to Hollywood to get warm because I was sick of freezing in Ohio during the winter, joked Luke. LOL.
Los Angeles is a great place to pick up cheap Picassos, by the way.
And I hope your hunt for work won't be too protracted. Bad jokes.
That was a cute one.
Don't be obtuse, Dave.
Yeah.
are we done? Should
I keep well, I think it's the right thing to do. Is to mm-hmm. stop.
Yes.
Sarah, you need to follow your own moral compass.
I isosceles agree. What? I know. I'm sorry. Once I got here, I thought, quote, well, acting is really the reason why I'm here. Come on, let's get going. Great quote, dude. The two Ohioans found an apartment in Orange County near Los Angeles. It is actually spelled correctly this time. Luke enrolled in acting classes and found small parts at the local White Fire Theater in Sherman Oaks. He met David Baird, who became his acting coach. When his friend moved back to Ohio, Luke moved to Hollywood by himself. Bobby Hoffman, an agent. Hi, I'm an agent. Encouraged Luke. He told the young actor that he had real potential. Bobby told Luke to keep trying. Something would come his way. As he waited for auditions, Luke earned money doing odd jobs. He flipped hamburgers, sold shoes, and worked in a doorknob factory. He also worked at construction sites and on road crews. As what? A sign?
I remember that from the movie. They had him working on a road crew and then leaving early to go to an audition.
Yes, with one little smudge of asphalt on his face.
Yes, yes.
One of his jobs was to paint lines in the Torrance High School parking lot. Although he didn't know it at the time, that school would become the set for Beverly Hills 90210. And Buffy. Mm-hmm. All right. Then we turn the page and here's a picture of Luke Perry as a soap opera star. He's wearing a white button down with no tie and one of those like 50s jackets and looking like he just ate a bug. Luke went on hundreds of auditions. He tried out for commercials, radio voiceovers, TV shows, and small parts in movies. 1987, after 3 years of trying, Luke became discouraged, especially since he really was bad at math because he graduated in 85. Not 84, but anywho. Then he heard about a producer in New York who was casting parts for an afternoon TV soap opera. Luke flew to New York and read for the part. There, he met future 90210-er Ian Ziering, who was also trying out for the part. Neither Luke nor Ian got the part. I've said the part really a lot of times. Luke didn't give up. He tried out for another soap opera. On his 217th audition, he landed the role of Ned Bates and thus placed himself 2 degrees from your co-host, Sarah D. Bunting, on the ABC soap opera, Loving. Dun, dun, dun. My husband was on that.
Ooh.
And that is our selection.
Did they work together, Sarah?
According to that timeline, which the book seems to have a strange idea about like how long years actually are, but I would say no. I believe that my husband was killed off on location in Montreal in late 1986.
It was that poutine factory scene, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It took him forever to get there, too.
Yeah.
Nightman.
All right, let's go. Let's wrap this thing up.
Go with Sarah.
Well, I was waiting for the da-da-da-da and try not to laugh. Next time on Again With This, they shoot podcasts, don't they? A dance marathon goes pear-shaped for Steve. The monotone gang continues hassling Donna. And Dylan multitasks with a soulmate getaway / smuggling op? Sure. You'll need to ingest several balloons of Maalox in order to get a load of our visual aids for this and every other episode of Again With This. You can find those on our website. This is really distracting, Dave. Previously.tv. You can follow that website on Twitter at Previously.tv, and you can follow this podcast at AWT90210. I'm your mom's girlfriend. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is deeply symbolic Porsche Tara Ariano. She's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is Deus Ex Grandpa David T. Cole.
Is this your car?
Get away from her.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.